Hear the call throughout the land. Come and proudly take your stand. Now uphold your chieftain's hand. Roosevelt the cry. Blow the bugle, beat the drum. From the north and south they come. From the east and west they come. Roosevelt the cry. Name McKinley's too. They traduced and would anew. Trust them? I will not. Would you? Roosevelt the cry. Let the Democrat named Hill all his evil venom spill, yet he'll taste a bitter pill. Roosevelt the cry. History shall write his name on the immortal scroll of fame. They shall all his deeds proclaim. Roosevelt the cry. Roosevelt the soldier true. Roosevelt the statesman too. Sane for me and safe for you. Roosevelt the cry.
Teddy Roosevelt's campaign song from 1904, Roosevelt the Cry, sung by Oscar Brand. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Theodore Roosevelt was a political powerhouse. He was a New York lawmaker at the age of 23. He was governor of New York at 40. At age 42, he was president, the youngest man to hold the office of president. Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris examines Roosevelt's presidency in Theodore Rex, the second of his three-volume biography of Roosevelt. Theodore Rex begins as Vice President Roosevelt receives the news that William McKinley has been shot. It concludes as William Howard Taft wins election as the nation's 24th president. In between Roosevelt and America at the outset of the 20th century, a time, as the book's description puts it, when America faced the harbingers of all the major issues of the new century: imperialism, industrialism, conservation, immigration, labor, race, plus the overall challenge that intimidated McKinley, how to harness America's new power as the world's richest nation. Theodore Rex follows the rise of Theodore Roosevelt, for which Morris won the Pulitzer Prize and the American Book Award. Listeners, I welcome your questions for Edmund Morris. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Edmund Morris, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, and thank you. And let me say that introductory sound clip reinforces a theory I've always had, that no one with an ear for music will ever be able to have a successful career in American politics.
Those campaign songs are pretty awful, aren't they?
Absolutely frightful. And I noticed that they consistently mispronounced the name Roosevelt all the way through, which, of course, drove both Presidents Roosevelt crazy. It was Roosevelt, Roosevelt,
yeah,
which they couldn't stand.
Yeah. Well,
they
even
sort of swallowed the last syllable. They tended to say Roosevelt.
Mm.
Roosevelt, mm. Roosevelt.
Yeah. Well, I can remember watching All in the Family when Archie Bunker would, you know, put down Franklin by saying Roosevelt.
That's right.
Yeah.
Much as people used to do with Ronald Reagan, they would pronounce it Regan, and knowing that that would drive Reagan intimates crazy, although he couldn't care less himself.
Yeah. Well, the book's description and Roosevelt's time as president, 1901 through the election of Taft in 1908, here we have the major issues of the new century, and it strikes me that there are just striking parallels between our time and that of Theodore Roosevelt, aren't there?
You're absolutely right. And I must say, I never anticipated this when I was, during the many years I've spent writing Theodore Rex. I did take a detour of many years into writing Ronald Reagan's biography. So when I wrote the prologue to Theodore Rex, which now seems to be so uncannily reflective of the time we've been going through exactly 100 years later, I never anticipated that his accession to power and his dealing with the terrorist crisis of 1901 would be so similar to what President Bush has had to deal with in September of 2001.
How did Roosevelt confront the situation that he faced after the assassination of McKinley in regard to anarchy and terrorism?
Well, he was aware, almost instinctually aware, I think, that the personality and the behavior and the demeanor of the president is vital to communicate a sense of security to the American people in times of crisis. We've seen this time and time again in our history, FDR confronting the Depression in 1932 and 1933, and Ronald Reagan confronting the neuroses of the 1970s in 1980, and TR in his time in 1901. So the very first messages he sent forth as the new young president, the youngest president we've ever had, were of unshakable moral resolve to fight terrorism, to fight anarchism, as it was called then, to telegraph the fact that our institutions, which seemed to be so vulnerable, witness the assassination of our third president in 36 years after Lincoln and Garfield and McKinley, that our institutions actually are invulnerable and strong. And he did that with rhetoric, his first great message to Congress in December of that year, which proclaimed his moral detestation of anarchism, the doctrines of terrorists who believed that they could bring down democracy. And he spoke out very harshly against unrestricted immigration. And within weeks of his assumption of power, the country, which was in a truly traumatized condition in September 1901, exactly as we were last September, within a few weeks, the country began to calm and accepted the fact that we had a young but very strong president in office. And from then on, he really, although he was security conscious for the rest of his two terms, from then on, he was able to deal with other and even more urgent matters, such as corporate control.
Hmm. And that's another issue we're facing today, once again.
Yes, there again. I mean, this very month, February, when we're also preoccupied, understandably preoccupied with Enron, 100 years ago, on February 19th, 1902, TR launched his historic prosecution of the Northern Securities Combination, which was the Enron of its time, this gigantic financial enterprise, a railroad combination, the largest railroad combination in the world, which had been formed in secret, whose operations were highly secret, and whose implications were definitely antitrust. So he astonished the entire corporate establishment by prosecuting it on under the dormant antitrust law, the Sherman Law, in February of 1902, and at the same time launched into a series of speeches and state papers which telegraphed his big obsessive message, and that is that great corporations, great business combinations, must operate in the full light of public scrutiny in return for the wealth that they accumulate. And you can be sure if he was, you could be sure if he was alive now that he would be enraged by the secrecy that has been the hallmark of the way Enron has conducted itself.
I wonder if anyone in the Bush administration has now taken a look at what Theodore Roosevelt had to say about the runaway capitalists of that time.
Well, I can tell you right away that the number one person in the Bush administration has taken a look at it. I know that President Bush read Theodore Rex over the Christmas holidays and seemed very favorably impressed with it, but I've often wondered if the many passages in it to do with government regulation of great corporations meant as much to him as some of the other aspects of TR's policies, because TR's attitude was by no means that of a conservative Republican these days.
No, conservative Republicans these days are interested in deregulation.
Exactly. And TR was very pro-regulation. Indeed, even before he became president, he was always remarkable for the vehemence with which he insisted that great corporations should be controlled and regulated and inspected.
And here we are in 1901. The country had come out of quite a depression, and productivity is booming, and some people are very, very wealthy and virtually free of regulation. J.P. Morgan is quoted in the book as saying, "I owe the public nothing."
Right. The traditional attitude of the self-satisfied capitalist. T.R. had to maintain a very delicate balance, which was something he loved to do. He loved to balance between extremes throughout his career. He had to balance between the natural dynamism of the American economy, which depends on free enterprise and laissez-faire. He had to balance that with the need for regulation, but he always understood that over-regulation and too much governmental power would cramp the growth of free enterprise. So his rhetoric tended to be sometimes almost amusingly even-handed between the need for regulation on one side and the need for encouragement of free enterprise on the other. There was a very popular dialectical humorist of the day called Mr. Dooley, the Irish humorous columnist, Finlay Peter Dunn, and he satirized the president's antitrust oratory by saying, quoting him as saying, "On the one hand, we must tread the trusts underfoot, but on the other hand, not so fast."
You know, Theodore Roosevelt had been in office just a very short time when the Department of Justice invoked the Sherman Act and struck out against the Northern Securities Company, which was one of the holdings of J.P. Morgan and E.H. Harriman.
Right.
And this came as quite a shock to the monopolists. It also, I would assume, came as quite a shock to Congress. How was the administration's move received in Congress?
Not very favorably, because Congress was dominated in those days by extremely conservative Republican senators. The Senate itself was at the height of its power vis-a-vis the executive and vis-a-vis the House. And it was ruthlessly controlled by a bunch of very serious conservative Republicans. And the most outspoken of them against the new president's policies was Senator Mark Hanna, who was the archetypal gold Republican. So a massive power struggle developed between the new young president and Senator Hanna, with Wall Street and all the corporate overlords, the Morgans and Harrimans of the world, trying to back Senator Hanna as the presidential candidate in 1904 against T.R. So for most of T.R.'s first term, he had to be very careful about how he dealt with the Senate, conscious of the fact that Wall Street would really like to run Senator Hanna against him. And it was only when he succeeded in being triumphantly elected in 1904 by a huge popular majority that he really felt the strength to forge ahead and become the most progressive president in our history thus far.
And what became of Hanna?
Well, he very conveniently died in the early part of 1904. But in any case, would probably not have gotten the nomination, because even by the early part of 1904, it was plain that the president's policies were prevailing, in particular when his suit against the Northern Securities Company was upheld by the Supreme Court in March of that year.
While people like Senator Mark Hanna and J.P. Morgan and Harriman were outraged at Roosevelt's trust-busting, Morgan and Harriman and others backed him in his bid for election in 1904. Why? And how much did they contribute to his campaign?
They contributed plenty, and the reason they backed him was businessmen will always go with a winning proposition. Mm-hmm. It was quite plain to them, as I say, even before Hannah died earlier that year, that the president was going to be elected. So they shifted their loyalty and reluctantly endorsed him, but endorsed him to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. E.H. Harriman contributed, in fact, led a last-minute fundraising effort for him in October of 1904. And therefore, signally helped his win, his electoral win in November that year. Whereupon they discovered to their chagrin that he was not going to repay them in kind. And as Henry Clay Frick complained afterwards, "We bought the son of a bitch," but he did not stay bought.
Hmm. Why did Roosevelt commit himself to just one campaign for election?
I think that's one of the genuinely great decisions of his two terms, that in 1908, when he could have had a third term on a silver plate for the asking, we must remember that he inherited his first term, he was vice president, mm-hmm. when McKinley was assassinated, so that was an inherited term, and really he was elected for the first time in 1904. So even if there had not, there was not in those days any limit on terms, but even if the two-term tradition established by George Washington had been sacrosanct, even then he could have, if he'd wanted, had another 4 years in the White House. He was only 48 years old, and he loved being in power. He loved power, and he was by then so popular that the American people genuinely wanted him to stay. But the moralist in him and the historian in him persuaded him that there's such a thing as too much power under the American system. He'd had, as the gift of the people, almost two full terms in the White House, and he felt that that gift should be returned to the people. So I think that was a great gesture to turn down that third term and leave the White House at the early age of 50. For idealistic and moralistic reasons.
But subsequently, and this is territory for the forthcoming third volume in your biography of Theodore Roosevelt, he did make another run for the presidency.
Yes, you see, he was human. Having given up power, he immediately began to hanker for it. And like so many strong executives, when they step down and hand over to their chosen successor, in this case, President William Howard Taft, like so many of these men, he began to chafe at the way his successor was conducting the business of the presidency and was convinced he could have done it much better himself. So inevitably, he ran again in 1912, the familiar story of challenging President Taft for the nomination, very nearly unseating him, much as Ronald Reagan did against Gerald Ford in 1976. And when he just failed to unseat Taft, and Taft was renominated, he then formed a third party and ran again for the presidency as the Progressive Party candidate, the Bull Moose Party candidate. To this day, it's our most successful third-party candidacy, but he was beaten in November of 1912. And as a result of his splitting the Republican vote, Woodrow Wilson, his nemesis, mm-hmm. became president.
Mm-hmm. How did Theodore Roosevelt view the issue of labor?
With remarkable enlightenment, I think, given the time and given his patrician background. When he was a young man, a young assemblyman in New York in the 1880s, he was very anti-labor, as most men of his class were in those days. And he was enraged by the Haymarket riots, for example, when he was all for sending in federal troops to shoot the rioters. But he became enlightened as the 19th century war drew to a close, and by the time he became president in 1901, his attitude to labor was quite moderate. And the big challenge that was thrown at him the following year in 1902 was the great anthracite strike, the coal strike, which amounted to a almost total energy stoppage for the country in the winter of 1902. And the strike was so serious, the United Mine Workers striking for recognition, that for the first time in history, the President of the United States stepped in and mediated between the forces of labor and capital and called his great coal strike conference in October of 1902, when he had the United Mine Workers sitting on one side of the room and the mine owners on the other, and forced a resolution to the strike, which redounded greatly to the comfort of the miners. So from then on, he was a hero to labor.
Did his square deal grow out of his view of labor and the struggles of working people?
It did indeed, yes. Whenever he talked about the face-off between labor and capital, he would bring out the square deal image, which he coined in 1903, and he found it politically so potent that he used it again and again and again. I think Franklin Roosevelt got his New Deal out of the square deal of his fifth cousin, Teddy. But then T.R., being a natural politician, began to apply the image to all the other polarities of the American political scene. Black versus white, wealth versus poverty, environmentalists versus the mining interests and things like that.
Labor was a critical issue, so too race, as you just mentioned. At this point in history, lynchings were commonplace. Blacks were being disenfranchised in the South. You note that by 1904, Southern legislatures would have taken the vote away from Black Americans. What were Roosevelt's views on race?
Well, certainly the vote was being taken away from Black Americans even before 1904. State by state, they were disenfranchising Blacks through the early part of the century. So you're quite right. If it hadn't been for Theodore Roosevelt's attitude and the racial policies that he enforced, it's quite likely that the American Black would have been totally disenfranchised by 1904, 1905. There again, he dealt with this enormous issue, much as he did with the issue of the trusts, by a very quick and dramatic action shortly after he became president. T.R. was a great believer in first impressions. And even before he prosecuted the trusts, within weeks of his accession to power in the fall of 1901, he issued his famous invitation to Booker T. Washington to come to have dinner in the White House, an intimate dinner, with himself and Mrs. Roosevelt and their children and a family friend. And this was the first time in our history that a Black man had ever sat down on equal terms in the White House with the President of the United States. Booker T. Washington being at that time the most prominent Black man in America. And the shockwaves that this invitation created across America, and particularly in the South, were so great that I think even T.R. himself was astonished by the vituperation that was instantly lavished on him in Southern newspapers and even on the floor of the House and in the Senate. It shocked him so badly that he never invited Booker T. Washington to dinner again, but the moral point had been made. And that point was that, as far as he was concerned, as president, any Black man who brought himself up to the level of Whitey by his own efforts, by his own smarts, was entitled to the greatest privileges the country could bestow, including dinner with the president.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is biographer Edmund Morris. We're talking with him about his book, Theodore Rex. It is the second of Morris's three-volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Rex follows the rise of Theodore Roosevelt, for which Morris won the Pulitzer Prize and the American Book Award. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 4, the toll-free line from Atlanta. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, too. Very interesting conversation. Theodore Roosevelt has always been one of my heroes, and I think my family's heroes for the fact that the work he's done did in conservation, like starting the national park system, etc. But however, on WILL-TV, there was a Black History discussion, and Theodore Roosevelt was pointed out as being a racist in that discussion, probably one of the few presidents that was pointed out in that light, other than maybe Abraham Lincoln, which is far out, but it was pointed out that maybe he was a racist too, and Theodore Roosevelt was thrown in that, and you've already kind of addressed that. Celeste got to that while I was dialing the phone, so I didn't get to bring that to the forefront first. But at least in certain Black cultural circles, that Theodore Roosevelt is considered a racist, and but I don't, you know, the stuff he did as far as the environment, I don't think any race can not applaud him for that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for what you said. And the point you made is important and should be addressed. In the first place, I'm not trying to argue that Theodore Roosevelt did not share the racial attitudes of most men of his class and of his time. Even though he was, by the standards of the time, comparatively enlightened, and his dinner to Booker T. Washington and his passionate statements against lynching being evidence of his enlightenment, he was certainly capable of patrician attitudes toward race. He frequently stated, for example, privately if not publicly, that he regarded the American black to be evolutionary behind American whites. And it was for that very reason that the great mass of the race seemed to him to be backward, that he so admired figures like Booker T. Washington, who advanced beyond the general mass of their race and reached the same level of eminence and achievement that he and his friends enjoyed by birthright. There is one very unfortunate story of his presidency, which I describe in documentary detail in Theodore Rex, which is not a pretty story, and that is the famous Brownsville episode of 1906, where racial injustice was perpetrated by the Roosevelt administration. And any historian, any biographer, has to be honest about this. I could very briefly recite the facts. There was a riot in Brownsville, Texas, in which the white citizens telegraphed the president to report that a battalion of black soldiers there, U.S. Army soldiers, had rioted overnight and had killed a white citizen of the town and wounded a white police officer. And they petitioned the president to get this battalion away from their lily-white community. Theodore Roosevelt investigated this alleged incident, and through the inspector general of his own War Department, he upheld the Army's opinion that the men had in fact rioted, even though there was never any hard evidence that they'd done so. And in the fall of that year, the President of the United States dishonorably discharged every man in that battalion. It was an impulsive act which he privately regretted afterwards, but he never rescinded that order, and that is certainly the largest blot on his presidential reputation.
We have another listener waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line 1. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Didn't the San Juan Hill thing happen with a lot of black soldiers as well? wasn't so. I would think you would have some camaraderie with, you know, some sympathy toward more than earlier than that.
Oh yes, yes, you had plenty of camaraderie, certainly deriving from the Spanish-American War, and there's no question that the charge up San Juan Heights, it was not just a hill, it was San Juan Heights. Let's be geographically clear about this. T.R.'s famous charge, which he personally led right to the top, was of a particular small hill called Kettle Hill, which was one eminence on the great massif known as San Juan Heights. And elsewhere on that massif, other regiments were also charging, one of which was a black regiment. So they were comrades in arms, and as I've said, throughout his life, he did feel a camaraderie, an affection, and an admiration for black Americans who distinguished themselves. But that did not prevent him taking a rather paternalistic attitude toward black Americans en masse.
Okay, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the relationship between Franklin and Theodore, because as I understand it, for Wilson's, I think it was, campaign, Franklin actually supported Wilson, which seems, you know, to be an indication that there must have been some sort of hostility there or something.
Oh, no, not at all. Franklin was a Democrat. The Roosevelt family, somewhere in the middle of the 19th century, sort of split up, and the Democratic Roosevelts congregated in the Hudson Valley of New York, and the Republican Roosevelts tended to congregate in Oyster Bay on Long Island. And when one of the Hyde Park Roosevelts was asked what the difference between themselves and the Oyster Bay crowd were, he said, oh, it's quite simple, we're better looking. But they were politically different, too. So Franklin came from that Democratic half of the family, and therefore his entire political career was anti-Republican. However, he always frankly admitted that he considered his cousin Theodore to be the greatest man he ever knew, and Franklin, from early youth, modeled himself on T.R. He went to Harvard. He subsequently went to the New York State Legislature. He became Assistant Secretary of the Navy and then Governor of New York and finally President. And he unquestionably modeled himself on Teddy.
Hmm. Oh, one last question. I understand that after his Theodore's boxing accident and he couldn't see so well, he was an unholy terror when it came to hunting. Somebody recently called him a cross between Mr. Magoo and a Tasmanian devil because he would just shoot and shoot and shoot. And that was his method. Did you find that? Can you corroborate that? Is that the truth?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the most trying things for a writer, a biographer, or a historian is to make people understand that the values of the present, our values now, our ethics and our morals, in the year 2002, are irreconcilable with the values of 100 years ago. It's all very well to say a man was a racist in 1902 when the word racism was not even understood. And now that hunting is something that shocks a large number of people, it's hard for us to understand that hunting was universally accepted back then, particularly amongst members of TR's rather upper crust class, as the honorable pursuit of a gentleman. So all his shooting, all his bloodlust, which is undeniable, were typical of his class and his kind. What interests me much more than making idle comparisons between attitudes now and then is the fact that in his time, even as he was shooting all these animals, which went on all through his life, he was simultaneously a lover of nature and a lover of animals and an expert, a natural historian, a zoologist, a paleontologist, an ornithologist, of the most passionate kind. And it interests me as a biographer, and I've spent 20 years trying to explain, or at least to investigate, how a man who loved animals so much and who understood them so well should be so ceaselessly compelled to kill them.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. What inspired Theodore Roosevelt to be such a strong advocate for conservation?
Well, that same love of nature that I was talking mm-hmm. about, I came across a letter that he wrote at the age of 10 to his mother, who was on a trip down to the south where she came from. It was in response to some letter she'd written him, and he said, "Dear mother, I'm so sorry to hear the trees have been cut down." In that single sentence, I detect the beginning of the later conservationist. He had an almost pantheistic love of nature, and particular veneration for trees and the birds that sat in them and sang in them. And he brought to the White House this intense love of nature, which he sort of associated with freedom and health and the outdoors, the environment that had turned him from a childhood invalid into the strong, famous, mm-hmm. barrel-chested outdoors man we're familiar with. Even so, though, it was only when he was president and he took his great cross-country trip in spring of 1903 across the Rockies into California, it was then that his conservation conscience blossomed out most fully. And he spent the rest of his years in office trying to make Americans understand the necessity for conservation of national resources, getting them to understand that our inventory of resources was running out even then. And I think that the Governor's Conference, which he arranged in 1908 to take an inventory of national resources and make conservation a matter of state policy, was his single greatest achievement as president.
Was that difficult for him to achieve? What was the attitude of the day toward preserving land for parks?
Yes, it was difficult for him to achieve, partly because the American people on the whole were totally ignorant of what conservation even meant as a word. There was this general national feeling that our resources were inexhaustible, that there would be always more trees across the horizon to harvest, and that rivers would clean themselves, and so on. And he made the American people understand these resources were actually very vulnerable and running out fast. And on the other side, he had to fight the same corporate interests that we've been talking about earlier on in this mm-hmm. program, the conservative senators who blanched at any idea of water regulation in the West and reclamation policy and setting aside national forests and this kind of thing. As the Speaker of the House once shouted out, "Not one penny for scenery." So it was that kind of antagonism that he had to combat.
Yeah. The time is rapidly slipping away, moving away from us. And before it goes completely, I do want to talk with you about foreign policy. What were his successes? What were his failures?
His greatest success was, without doubt, what he got the Nobel Peace Prize for, and that was mediating a settlement of the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, and simultaneously mediating a settlement of the Morocco crisis, which is rather less well known. For that, he got the Nobel Peace Prize at the end of 1906. And I think one of the reasons he was so effective as a diplomat was that, unlike any president subsequently that I can think of, and certainly unlike most presidents before, he understood foreign cultures. He was so deeply read in the history of Russia and the history of Japan, and for that matter, the history of Islam, that when he dealt with these countries, he understood their sensibilities, and that made him all the more effective as a diplomat. He remains to this day the only president, I believe, who's ever been asked to mediate the end of a foreign war.
Henry James dubbed him Theodore Rex. That's where the title of the book comes from. Was James right to dub him Rex? And how do you judge Judge Roosevelt's actions in Panama, for example.
James was right, although, of course, James was being arch, as he usually was in his private letters. He was amused by the kingly way that T.R. conducted himself at the height of his power in the White House. It was lots of ceremony and uniforms and regal command. But if you are referring to imperialism, which is a definite foreign policy tendency of the time, and now talking about the Panama Canoe as an example of T.R.'s imperialism, well, that's a serious matter. And if we, I don't know how much time we have, but we can certainly talk about that. I'll be very brief and simply say that the revolution that broke out in Panama in 1903, which was an attempt of Panama to separate itself from Colombia, it was then a province of Colombia, was something like the 55th or 56th annual rebellion that that little province had had against Colombia since the middle of the 19th century. And T.R., who wanted to build the Panama Canal across Panama, took advantage of this latest rebellion to send in a gunboat and prevent the Colombians from suppressing the rebellion. Panama therefore declared itself independent, and lo and behold, we began to build the canal.
We've got a couple of callers waiting, and we're about 5 minutes away from having to wrap things up. Let's see if we can get our callers in. Next, we're going to go to the toll-free line, Farmer City. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wonder if we might slip into a movie review. You mentioned the Moroccan crisis. I wonder if you have seen the movie The Wind and the Lion, which is, you know, very loosely based on the kidnapping incident in Morocco. And I wonder if you could just say, you know, as far as the characterization of Roosevelt, which I thought was marvelous, but would you regard that as true to form?
Well, I'll say only this. It was a stupid movie, but it certainly was a good performance by Brian Keith. He was an excellent Theodore Roosevelt. But the movie was almost ludicrously hokey. I mean, the U.S. citizen kidnapped in Morocco turned out to be Candice Bergen, whereas actually it was an old man called Jan Perdicaris. And T.R. landed no Marines on Moroccan soil. So the movie was a movie, and a lot of people saw it, but it's very bad history. The crisis that did occur when T.R. indeed sent the United States Navy in to force Morocco to free this American citizen is a good enough story in itself to be told, and I do tell the story in my book. And I think, indeed, if it was filmed just straight, it would make an even more effective movie.
Let's talk with the second listener who's waiting for us in Chicago on line one. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I've enjoyed reading the biographies of Winston Churchill, but unfortunately the writer now, I understand, has a stroke and is unable to complete the third volume. But I'll be looking forward to your writings, and I enjoyed the reviews your book has received so far, and even the quote recently by the columnist David Broder about your reference to Roosevelt's alarm about the rise and the power and influence of the corporation sector, and hope that the message would not be lost upon our current President Bush. But more so to the point, be it any leader, the idea of one person being able to encompass all the areas that are needed for direction and assimilation of all the things that are occurring seems to be more than one person should handle. And I was wondering if you feel that the office of presidency or other prime ministers and so forth must be expanded upon so that they're not overwhelmed, because it's beyond the capacity of one individual to really assimilate and digest and carry on the things that are needed. What do you think about the matter of leadership today?
Well, sir, I respectfully disagree with you. There certainly have been times when the presidency has seemed to be too much for our president, but that's simply because of the incompetence of the president. For example, it became almost a commonplace to say in the late 1970s, and I think President Carter said it himself, that the office had grown too big for the man, And LBJ was very lachrymose on the subject, too. But in comes Ronald Reagan, who showed that the presidency could be easily handled by a man with strong and simple ideology. And he left office one of the few presidents in our history who was as happy to go as he was to come. And Theodore Roosevelt, in his encyclopedic breadth and his total command of political strategy and his enormous knowledge of foreign relations, his extraordinary energy and dynamism, is an even better example of the fact that we can have presidents who can effortlessly encompass the whole of their job.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. And we are at the point where we have to say goodbye to you, Mr. Morris. But before we do, I do want to ask you, given that there is so much material to draw on in the life of Theodore Roosevelt, how did you manage? How are you managing to deal with the wealth of material that you have to draw on as a biographer?
Well, I said to my wife the other day when I was looking through some of the cards that I'm putting away that I based Theodore X on, I said, you know, I really could have written another book almost as long using stuff that I didn't put into Theodore X. Any writer who writes any biography or any book has got to consider the principle of exclusion, and one has to select the items, the stories, the precepts that seem particularly important. And I'm sure other writers will come along and find him an equally rich subject. So.
Well, the book is filled with wonderful detail, and I imagine that The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt is as well. And you mentioned your wife, and the biographer Sylvia Jukes Morris, by the way, will be our guest here on this program tomorrow. We'll talk with her about Edith Kermit Roosevelt. So, Edmund Morris, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. I greatly enjoyed it.
Theodore Rex is the second in a planned 3-volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt from Edmund Morris. The first, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, was the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the American Book Award.